I'm just going to wrap up with a couple of things I didn't get to this morning that I meant to bring up, and that is talk briefly about some of the methods that have been developed in the last 20, 25 years that have actually caused part of this revolution in molecular biology, or at least a revolution in the amount and the kinds of data that we can get access to that we didn't used to be able to get. So in the early 70s, there were two things that happened, each of which resulted in Nobel Prizes. One was the ability to efficiently move DNA into a cell. I mean, it's always easy to get DNA out of a cell, but you end up killing the cell. The harder part was to get DNA into a cell without and have the cell incorporate that DNA and go on and treat it as if it was its own DNA. And then the second was the discovery of restriction enzymes, which are enzymes that will recognize particular sequences in DNA and cut the DNA at that point. Because it turns out that when you put these two things together, you get cloning. Now the word cloning is used in lots of different contexts. What it really just means is the ability to copy something and replicate it. So you hear about cloning a cow or cloning things like that. But for biologists, mostly what we're interested in is cloning genes. So the idea is here's a bacteria cell, which is where you clone most things. The idea is you could take a plasma that is a small circular DNA that's sort of self-replicating. It will propagate itself once it gets inside the bacteria. You cut that, and then you can take foreign DNA from anywhere, from humans or plants or whatever you want, cut it up, and these restriction enzymes let you what's called ligate them back together. That is, join them into a single circle, put them into the bacteria, and then they just go on propagating from that point on. And so the ability to do this step, this transformation, get the DNA in and get the cell to treat it as if it was its own DNA, and then the ability to put whatever DNA you want in there, the whole basis for cloning. It's the whole basis for the genetic engineering industry.
Can you do that? The bacteria would change its character?
It may or may not. I mean, oftentimes what you do is in the plasmid itself, you'll put some gene that you can select for. So you put an antibiotic resistance gene, and therefore you can select for the cells. Because this transformation, again, is not 100%. Efficient. So some of them will uptake the DNA and some of them won't. And so you want to select for the ones that have it. So that's a simple thing. The DNA that you put in, if it's a human gene for, beta globin or something, it's probably not even going to be expressed in these cells, although it might be. But it's simply a way of making lots of copies of it. There are ways, oftentimes, to turn on the expression of that gene and to purify a particular protein. So mostly this is done in bacteria, but you can also do it in yeast cells and other kinds of cells as well. Just because bacteria grow so fast, if you want to make a huge amount of something, the bacteria is the most efficient way to get to make a large amount of whatever it is you're interested in. The next major breakthrough was in 1977. There were two papers that came out describing methods for doing DNA sequencing. Prior to that, it was very difficult, very laborious to do DNA sequencing of any kind. In fact, in 1975, David Pribnow published a paper on DNA he got a PhD from Harvard for determining the sequence of the nowadays, we've sequenced the entire human genome, which is 3 billion base pairs of DNA over the last few years. So what happened was in 1977, there was this advance in how one does DNA sequencing. And the idea actually is quite simple, although it took a while for the idea to sort of be realized, and then it took some more engineering steps to make it a reality. But I thought I'd just outline for you what the idea is based on. I mentioned earlier, this is DNA and this is RNA, and the letters are simply, make sure I get this right, since they're not listed on here. This is a C, and that's, this is a T, and this is a U. So this is the one difference where DNA has a T in it, which has this methyl group. U doesn't, we're missing that methyl group. Otherwise, these bases are pretty much the same. So a G looks the same, whether it's DNA or RNA, and an A looks the same, with one difference, and that is this OH group down here that I told you about. And that OH group actually makes it, makes the RNA unstable. But what you have to remember is that when you make a string of RNA, what you're doing is you're connecting the phosphate of one group onto this oxygen of another group right here, and so you can just link them up in a long chain. So what was realized was that if I give it a DNA that's missing this oxygen, so it's called a dideoxynucleotide, instead of a deoxynucleotide, it's dideoxy because it doesn't have any oxygens around here, that causes the chain to stop. I can put that nucleotide in, it will get hooked up by its phosphate to the previous base, but I can't extend that chain anymore. So in fact, the whole process of sequence, the other thing so here's an example of a dideoxynucleotide, it has no OH group on it, so it can't be extended. And so whenever I'm doing DNA synthesis, I'll be adding new DNA to my chain, and then as soon as I put one of these molecules in, it stops. Well, remember, I also told you that DNA polymerases don't start de novo. They have to have a primer to start with. So what that means is that if I want to sequence a piece of DNA, so here's a template whose sequence I want to determine, I can synthesize a little primer. I can design my primer wherever I want it to be, and it will base pair to that piece of DNA. And then I'll take this tube and I have a mixture of the DNA plus the primer, and I'll separate that into four different tubes, one of which has dideoxy A in it, plus all the regular ACGT. This one has all the regular ACGT plus dideoxy C. So what will happen is that some probability when it comes to where an A goes in, with some probability it'll stop at that point. Sometimes it'll go through because it has some of the regular A, but it also has some of this dideoxy A. So sometimes it'll stop with an A. And this time, well, sometimes it'll stop with a C and so on. So all of these chains start at the same point because of the primer defines where they start from. And so by looking at where they end, I can tell what base occurs at that position in the sequence. So all I have to do is have a method to separate DNA strands by length. So you run them down a gel. I don't know if you're familiar with polyacrylamide gel, but basically it's a sieve that these things, you put an electric current in it and the DNA goes through it. And how fast it migrates depends on its length. So the shorter it is, the faster it migrates. And so I now, and these are, in the old days, these were radioactively labeled, and I would just run one. This is the A lane, the C lane, the G lane, and the T lane. And I can just read the sequence right off here. It goes A, G, C, C, T. I notice actually this figure has an error in it. This band right there is supposed to be over here. But anyway, you can just simply read the sequence that's been determined in this way. So this is a technique that was invented in 1977 and suddenly led to the ability to do DNA sequencing, which before that was difficult or impossible. In fact, nowadays they don't label these radioactively, they label them fluorescently, and then they do it in such that the dideoxynucleotide itself is fluorescently labeled. So now you can mix them all into one test tube instead of separating them into four test tubes. And unfortunately, I couldn't find a good picture when I was looking for one, but now you have a single lane and you just read the colors. So the colors up a single lane go red, green, green, blue, yellow, green, green, red. Then you know that means the sequence was A, T, T, C, G, G, etc. Just by reading the color up a lane of the gel. And obviously, once you've got this down, you can pretty much all of these steps can be automated with little robots that add the chemicals and everything and run things on the gel. And that whole automation process has gotten more and more efficient, and that's what led that company, Celera, to basically be able to sequence the human genome in the course of about 6 months period of time, because they have essentially they have about 300 machines, each of which can generate about I forget the exact number, several hundred thousand base pairs of sequence per day. If you multiply all that stuff out, it turns out you can sequence the whole human genome in about 6 months, which is what they did. So the shotgun method has to do with, let me put up another slide. Just for illustrative purposes. So this is, I wanted to point out, 1995, July 28th, this was the publication of the first complete genome. This is a bacteria, Haemophilus influenza, but I just to point out that it was just, 5.5 years ago that the first complete genome was done. And there are now, 30 bacteria that have been sequenced, human, yeast, a whole bunch of stuff has happened in the last 5 years. The shotgun strategy, so there are basically two approaches that have been taken to sequence genomes. One is to, first of all, do exhaustive mapping. That is, you would break the chromosome up. So I'll use this as an example, although you can do the same thing on very big genomes, for instance, the human genome. So one process is you would, first of all, break this up into segments more or less randomly, and then match how those segments overlap with each other. Let me show you this on another slide. So let's talk about it in terms of a linear, like a human chromosome. Is that showing up? Okay. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to just sort of break this chromosome up randomly into fragments. And so, actually let me do it differently. So the fragments broken up randomly, they'll overlap in various ways. That is visible to see. If I just break it up randomly, I get sort of all kinds of sheared fragments. I can select them so they're more or less the same size, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, the point is that they will cover the whole genome randomly. And then the old strategy, and it's still used by people, but the idea was to do mapping and see if this one overlaps this one, and this one overlaps that one a lot, so there's no use sequencing both of these. I want to find a minimum piling path such that I do the minimum amount of sequencing to get the whole genome. And so I would pick up a path of overlapping fragments, and then once I defined that path, then I would just sequence those. And so there's more upfront work because I have to do quite a bit of mapping, but when I'm done, I have sort of the minimum amount that I have to sequence. The whole shotgun approach means I take this original shotgun material and I just sequence it all, knowing that in the end, I'm going to have a lot of redundancy, but that redundancy is actually useful in terms of putting the sequence back together. Like that redundancy is essential to putting the sequence back together again. But I don't worry about doing any of this mapping stuff, because in fact, I'm going to rely on redundancy in the final product anyway. So instead of trying to pick a minimum path in which to do sequencing, I just sequence the whole randomly sheared stuff. And typically, you do that at a depth, what they call a depth of 6 to 10. That is, any one, on average, any one position has been sequenced 6 to 10 times. But that's sufficient that there are very few gaps. And there still remain some gaps that got sequenced 0 times. But most of the sequence got, you know, on average, if it's average of 6 to 10, and sometimes some regions got sequenced 20 times, and a few of them got sequenced 0 times. I have to go back and fill in those gaps.
How much overlap do you need before you need an overlap and not just accidentally?
If it weren't for repetitive DNA, then it would be pretty straightforward. You probably only need, because the sequence itself is pretty high quality. I mean, a single sequencing read has an error rate of a percent or so, something like that. So if I have an overlap that's maybe 50 or 60 base pairs, I'm pretty confident that's real. Except for the fact that human DNA is littered with repetitive sequences that occur over and over again. That's the majority of this so-called junk DNA. So these repetitive sequences are themselves, 95% identical. They've accumulated over time some differences, but that ends up being the real rub, and the reason that the shotgun method, many people thought it wouldn't work. Celera showed that it would, unless you believe some people who said that it still doesn't work, because they're not convinced that the Celera sequence is completely right, although it's probably mostly right. The real difficult problem has to do with this repetitive sequences within the genome that when you do the complete shearing, you're not quite sure when you're putting two things together if they really belong together or they're just closely related sequences that are put together by mistake.
When you take the DNA and double it up into different bits, are these all separated and individually sequenced?
Yeah. You don't sequence them in mass. What you do is you chop them up and then you clone them, like I showed you before. So you put them into a bacteria, you can grow up lots of it, and then each one of those things you just put into the machine, and the machine...
How do you differentiate between these are all the same length?
They're the same length, but any single bacteria is only going to... So this is my foreign DNA, and I'm just showing you something here, but imagine that that's the whole genome, and I've cut it up into little fragments like this. Any one plasmid is just going to get one of these fragments and it's going to go into one bacteria. So now I grow up my bacteria and I spread them out on the plate such that I have a little colony of bacteria. All the cells, so there might be 10 to the 8th cells in a little colony, they all have exactly the same piece of DNA in it. And a different colony will have a different piece of DNA in it. So what I do is I extract the DNA from one colony and I sequence that. And that's the sequence of one of these little fragments of DNA. And having accumulated enough of these little fragments, I can then reconstruct what the underlying sequence is that gave rise to all those fragments. That's the basic technology. Of course, sequencing DNA, in order to become really efficient, you had to also make the ability to synthesize DNA efficiently. And for a long time, that wasn't easy, but in about 1979, just basically some good chemists figured out how to do that. So now you can synthesize pretty long pieces of DNA at will, which is of course essential for making all these primers and everything that you need. PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. Again, this is an idea that resulted in a Nobel Prize. It's one of these ideas that in retrospect is so simple you wish you'd thought of it first, but you know, it took somebody to actually come up with it first. And the idea is that, again, taking advantage of the fact that DNA polymerase will only extend from a primer, the goal here was to amplify and get a huge number of copies for some defined piece of DNA that I care about. And this can be done for purposes of cloning, or it can be done for purposes of forensic. But basically what I can start with is a single molecule of DNA and then end up with a huge amount of it. And the basic idea is very simple. So I define the primers, which are indicated by these little blue boxes right here. So if I start with a piece of DNA and let's say I want to amplify what's in this green section in between. Oops, sorry. I want to amplify this section in between. So I synthesize on a machine a little primer for one end and a little primer for the other end. And I make enough of that it's in huge excess. First thing I do is I melt the DNA. So I just raise the temperature so that the two strands come apart. I throw in the primer, it anneals there, and that lets me make a copy that direction, make a copy that direction. I melt open the DNA again, and I repeat. Remember, my primer is in excess, so I always have a lot of extra primer on. It anneals there and anneals there, and it keeps making copies, and eventually I end up with it grows exponentially. That's why it was called the polymerase chain reaction, like a nuclear chain reaction. The idea is that at every round, I'm essentially doubling the number of copies of the region that's just between my two primers. So initially, I start at this primer and I synthesize all the way out to the end. But later on, and the next time I'm copying one, and it ends at this point, so I only copy that far. And eventually, I end up with a huge amplification just of the region between my two primers. Is that clear?
Gary?
Yeah.
What's the error rate on that? There's no proof
for you. Well, that depends on what enzyme you use to do the primers. You have your choice of different enzymes that you can use. Sometimes, in fact, people use you can also do PCR where you start with an RNA fragment, and then the first step has to be this reverse transcriptase that copies from RNA into DNA, and that has a higher error rate. But you can use in this PCR, you can either use high fidelity PCR that basically has a very low error rate, depending on the polymerase, or you can use things that have amplified error rates. There still is none of that secondary proofreading that goes on. So the error rates are probably 1 in 10 to the 4th or something at the best. But you can make the error rates higher than that if you want to.
You just have a true problem with these things in primary.
Right. And this, again, can be completely automated. So once you synthesize your primers and you put them into a test tube with the DNA template, and then you throw in the enzyme, and you do this with an enzyme which is heat stable, that is, the enzyme itself is tolerant to being heated up and cooled down and stuff like that. And you just let it cycle, and the machine goes up to 95 degrees where it melts the DNA, and then it goes down to 75 degrees where the enzyme works, and it makes copies of the DNA, and then it goes back up to 95, and you can cycle every 2 or 3 minutes or so. So basically, in the course of an hour, you can start with one copy of DNA and end up with, let's say, 2 to the 12 copies of DNA or something like that, an hour later, depending on how long the cycle time would be.
Excuse me. Yeah. I'm confused between these two slides, right? This is an older technology.
This is strictly, I'm just showing you for sequencing.
Right.
This is PCR, so...
So if you have these primers, then before you were worrying about all these things overlapping,
mm-hmm.
But if you have these primers,
right. The problem is that this procedure is designed for sequencing, for determining an unknown sequence. So I don't know, in other words, for this one, I have to know the sequence, at least where these primers go, because I have to know what sequence to make these primers be. In this sequence, I don't have any information to start with.
You can design the primers to go wherever you want.
To go wherever you want. So I can design them to amplify particular genes. And that's what they're used for routinely now.
So they are artificially generated.
Right.
Right.
To do what? Yeah, but in this case over here, oops, my primers. Remember, I randomly sheared this DNA and I put it into this plasmid. I do my sequencing primers from the plasmid. I know the sequence of the plasmid, so I make my primers here, and then I sequence into the unknown sequence, starting from my known sequence.
Right.
for a sequence across the boundary of where the primer is, of where the insert is in the plasma. Right? So my primer matches right here, and then I sequence from starting at known sequence through the unknown sequence. Okay, was there anything else I wanted to mention on here? In vitro selections, that's a topic that we'll come back to. That is, it's now possible to do, basically combine methods like PCR along with in vitro selecting RNAs that have particular capabilities. I mean, this has to do with in vitro evolution, molecular breeding kind of stuff. That's going to be a topic later on. That was really invented in the middle 80s and has taken off in the last 10 years. Gene disruptions in eukaryotes. We've been able to do this in yeast for a long time, but really just in the last 10 years or so, they've been able to go in, and usually it's done in mice, go in and actually, if you want to know the effect of a gene, you've identified a gene, but you don't really know what its effect is. Well, one way you can do that is to go in and knock it out and see what effect that has on the phenotype. That was it is still a difficult procedure, but it's possible to do it. So in fact, it's conceivable that in the next 10 years or so, we'll be able to go in and knock out genes in mice and see what their overall effect on the biology is. You replace it with a dead gene somehow. You basically inactivate the gene in some way. There are different ways to do it, but basically you eliminate the function of that gene. One thing that's not on here that's, of course, just happened in the last few years are these DNA chip experiments whereby you can, again, by you synthesize DNA either by synthesizing short pieces by themselves, where short might mean 20 or 30 or 40 long, and put them down on a chip, or you can amplify genes by PCR. But again, in the end, what you do is you have a chip, you know, literally this big, that might have a piece of DNA for all, you know, 6,000 genes in yeast, or maybe all 40,000 genes in human, and then that DNA, which is on a chip, you can use it to measure the expression of the genes inside a cell. So imagine I have a cell population. This might work better as a picture. I can bring one. So here's my DNA chip, and it's addressable. So at this particular spot on my chip, I've put down a particular DNA sequence. Now I have a cell over here, and remember this cell is expressing certain genes. So what I do is I take the RNA outside of that cell, and I put it onto this chip. Well, if this DNA here that corresponds to this RNA, they'll come together and make a signal. And usually, I label that fluorescently or something so I can detect it in a microscope. But I can see that, you know, this particular gene is expressed because the RNA exists in the cell. There might be another gene I put down its DNA over here, but if that's not expressed in the cell, then there'll be no signal. There'll be nothing for the DNA and the RNA to bind to it. And so this is a way to take a population of cells. It's not sensitive enough that I can take a single cell, but I can take a population of cells that I think are all behaving the same, extract their RNA, and then put it on a chip, and I can monitor, I can ask, well, which genes really are expressed, and furthermore, at what level? I want to know some genes are expressed at a very high level, and some genes are expressed at a very low level. And of course, the really interesting stuff is I can then manipulate these cells. Either I can take a time course, I can see how these cells, how the expression of different genes changes over time, or how it changes in response to stimulus in the environment. If I, you know, raise the temperature or whatever I do in the environment, I can see how that affects the expression of all these genes. Yes, it can be. So there are a couple different ways this is done. There's a company called Affymetrix that does this by photolithography, pretty much like a computer chip, and then they synthesize the DNA. So they would synthesize a little 20-long sequence, you know, A, T, G, etc., about 20 long, and they would synthesize it right on this chip. And the chip is on the order of a couple centimeters across, and it has, you can put these things down at a density of something like 12,000 different spots. Each spot has a unique sequence attached to it that I can use to measure the expression from. There are other ways in which I might take a set of genes and I might amplify by PCR, and so now I might end up not with a little 20 or 30 more, but I might end up with something that's 300 or 400 long. But again, I can then spot that down into a little particular spot on the chip. This is usually done just on a glass slide. It's rather than a silicon chip. But the idea is the same.
Not one molecule.
There'd be one sequence right here, but there might be 10,000 individual molecules at that spot. So that allows me to measure concentration ranges.
Gary, would you put the RNA interference on the same list?
Yeah, RNA's interference is a new technique. Has mostly been RNAi. RNA interference was originally discovered and applied in worms, but it turns out to be applicable to lots of other systems. This is a way to turn off the expression of a particular gene. You put in the RNA, and people still don't know exactly how it works, but it was observed that if I put in double-stranded RNA, it corresponds to a gene that's being expressed in a certain cell, it'll turn off the expression of that gene. People think that this is the cells, the organism learned how to do this as basically as a response to being infected by an RNA virus. They learned to recognize double-stranded RNA, which is something that cells normally don't make double-stranded RNA, they only make single-stranded RNA. So if double-stranded RNA gets into the cell, they recognize it as being virus, and they basically try to turn off the expression of that virus. So now you can manipulate that, you can inject your own RNA into these cells, and it will turn off, you know, you inject the RNA that corresponds to a gene that you want to turn off, and it will turn off that gene for you. Unfortunately, it doesn't work in mammalian cells, so it's not something you can do in humans or mice, but you can do it in Drosophila, apparently it works. It certainly works in C. elegans and lots of other species. Again, a relatively new technique that's going to basically give us the ability to do lots of things that we couldn't do before. So anyway, these are all techniques that have really happened just in the last 20 years that have basically increased our ability to collect lots of data in a pretty short period of time. I was looking through some old slides in this lecture. I came across this one from 1992 showing the growth of the sequence database. Remember I told you that the whole method for doing DNA sequencing was invented in 1977. So right around 78, 79, 80, sequences first started appearing in the literature. In fact, the first database, the EMBL database, that's the European Molecular Biology Lab DNA database, started in 1982. GenBank started the following year, 1983. And this was a record of the increase in the total amount of sequence, making in millions of base pairs of sequence. And it's a classic exponential looking curve, right? As the technology suddenly became available, more and more sequences were being collected. Well, everybody knows that exponential curves can't continue forever. They have to plateau at some point. So the question is, well, when is this going to plateau? And people kept predicting, well, next year it's going to level off, or the year after that it's going to level off. So about, I think in 77, 5 years later, I decided to update that slide. So that's what the slide looked like in 97. So it hadn't yet plateaued in 1997. It's up here where it crossed this 500 million base pairs, that is half a billion base pairs in about 96 or so, so it crossed that line. Then this is the slide that Terry showed yesterday. So this is current. Continuing the slide, notice that here's 1996 and it crosses the baseline. But the baseline here isn't zero. The baseline there is 500 million base pairs. So in fact, everything I showed you before was not on this slide. It's off the bottom. But it doesn't matter because it's so flat that it's basically... So it still is an exponential curve. And for the foreseeable future, it looks like it's going to remain an exponential growth curve. And just the amount of data, this is just the raw amount of raw base pairs of DNA going into the public databases. Okay. So the next topic is talking about RNA. So RNA, just to introduce, is like DNA, except for these differences. I already pointed out it's got a 2' OH, so it has one more oxygen since DNA is deoxy. It's missing this 2' OH. So that's the chemical difference. I also showed the difference between T and a U, but otherwise A, C, and G are chemically the same. It tends to be short, on the order of 100 to maybe 10,000 base pairs in length. I mentioned earlier that RNA is a copy of a one section of the DNA, but it's a copy that usually corresponds to one gene or maybe a few genes that are right next to each other within a chromosome. So in the idea of a complicated blueprint for a whole building that contains many pages, you might think of an RA representing one page out of that complete set of blueprints. The other thing is it exists in general, again with a few exceptions, as a single strand. That is, it's just synthesized as one strand, and you don't synthesize both strands to make double-stranded RNA, you just synthesize one strand. But of course, it still has the ability to form base pairs, and so it tends to fold up on itself. So you get, by and large, intramolecular structures. You can get base pairing between two RNAs, so you can get intermolecular structures, but it's more common to see intramolecular structure. And furthermore, and maybe most important for what I'm going to talk about the rest of the time, that you can, RNA has two purposes, really. The first, which sort of corresponds to its role in the central dogma I mentioned, is this informational, it's this intermediate, so-called messenger RNA, which is the copy of the piece of the DNA that corresponds to a gene, which is then used to do translation to make proteins with. But it turns out there are many RNAs that actually have a structural or enzymatic role in and of themselves, which is they're not simply messenger RNA that codes for some protein, but they have an intrinsic role inside the cell as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
When the RNA is double-stranded, does it go through a double-stranded?
Yes. So in fact, the first sort of well-characterized RNA is tRNA. So this is a piece of RNA which is involved in doing translation. So I'm going to get into what its main, the real essence of its function tomorrow when I talk about protein synthesis. But I just wanted to put this up as an example of an RNA. So the total RNA is about 80 nucleotides long. Sometimes they're a little longer, sometimes a little shorter. So it's synthesized as just one single strand, but you'll notice that it can fold up on itself. What's not so clear here is that, because it's not indicated, is that these are base pairs shown here. So it folds up into the so-called cloverleaf structure. This would be a planar representation of the structure, but in fact, in three dimensions, these are all different representations of the same three-dimensional structure. It could be much more complicated than that. Either way? These loops, yeah. These loops are generally not base pair. That's not base pair. There actually tends to be a constraint on how tight a turn you can make to come back in base pair. And the minimum size loop is about 3 nucleotides. These loops are somewhat longer than that. This loop right here, which is called the anticodon, this is going to be essential. This is for what's involved in decoding when we do the translation to protein. That is, this part right here is going to match up with the messenger RNA and tells you what amino acid gets placed in there. The amino acid itself gets stuck up on the other end of the tRNA. So the tRNA is an adapter that goes between the amino acid up here, which is part of the protein, and the codon right here, which is matching up with the RNA, and it's the thing that actually does the translation between the RNA sequence and the protein sequence. Okay? But my purpose right now is just to show you something about the structure of RNAs. So this is sort of a planar folding, but really it gets much more complicated. And in fact, this loop over here folds back and interacts with this loop over here. What? So some of these nucleotides actually get modified after the RNA is made. So this starts out as a U, and then it gets made into what's called a pseudo-U, which means basically it gets chemically modified slightly. So it's not a standard U anymore, it's been modified. And there are enzymes that do that. So this is a C that's been methylated. I pointed that out before, that there are enzymes that will methylate it. So there are some nucleotides that actually get modified. But initially, when it's transcribed as RNA, it's just straight RNA, just A, C, G, and U. And then, in the process of turning it into a tRNA, there are enzymes that do various things to it. If that was just a U, it would still fold up the same way. In fact, people have knocked out the enzymes that make these things, and they don't seem to be essential enzymes. It's not clear that why they exist. I mean, they may have some subtle selective advantage, but by and large, they don't seem to be all that important. Here's another picture, just the same picture, but in color, and maybe it looks a little better, I don't know. But anyway, the stems, and as I said, the one loop, and it comes back and interacts with the other loop, so that the overall structure is this sort of L-shaped thing, where the amino acid is stuck out here, and the anticodon loop is down here. So this is the part that's going to read the code in the RNA, This is the part where the amino acid is attached to it. There's one of these for each amino acid. In fact, there's often done more than one per amino acid, but there's at least one for each amino acid. I think it's mostly a steric effect. There are other complicated RNA structures. This is a intron sequence that has a... The reason I bring this up here is this was the first example of a catalytic RNA. So it turns out there's a messenger RNA. It's not actually shown on here. The messenger RNA comes out this direction, up through here, and then extends out here. And all this stuff in between is a so-called intervening sequence that actually gets clipped out, a process called splicing. It gets clipped out and removed from the initial transcript. So the initial transcript Here's the DNA that codes for a particular gene. I mean, there's a promoter here and a terminator here. So you make this transcript, but then it turns out there's this intron, it's called. It gets cleaved so that you end up with this sequence like that. Okay, so this would be the final messenger RNA. This would be what's called the pre-mRNA. It's the initial transcript, but its intron gets removed. And that's a process that happens in lots of eukaryotic genes. The reason I put this one up here is it turns out that this is an intron that cleaves itself out. It's a self-catalyzing process whose discovery led to Tom Cech getting a Nobel Prize. But this is the first example of an RNA actually having an enzymatic activity. In this case, the enzymatic activity depends very strongly on the overall structure of this. Again, the structure I'm just showing here is sort of a two-dimensional structure where it's been flattened out to show you where the helices are, but really it folds up into a three-dimensional structure. This structure has also been determined in crystallography just in the last couple of years, so we now know what the three-dimensional structure looks like. Most introns are junk, and so there are lots of genes in eukaryotes that have introns. In fact, a single gene may have multiple introns, and they get removed, and they don't seem to have any particular function. This one, it's not clear what its function is, other than to remove itself. Now, it's not clear why that would be selected in a group. So it does have this catalytic activity, but it's not clear what advantage it offers. Right. Right. What's that? No, most splicing is not of this form. Most splicing requires other proteins to help do the splicing. In fact, there's another one of these machines called the spliceosome that's involved in removing. So the spliceosome, so in this pre-RNA, there's this machine that comes in and recognizes signals here and here that says, okay, an intron begins here and an intron ends there, so I'm going to cut that piece of DNA, or cut that piece of RNA out, and then use the RNA back together. But like I said, a typical human gene might have lots and lots of introns that get removed before the final gene is spliced. And furthermore, this was the point that I alluded to earlier, is that a given gene, let's say I have a gene right here, and I can divide it up into sections where I have an exon, and then an intron, and an exon. Okay, so in the end, I might, but actually there can be times when I can do this in alternative ways. So another intron might go all the way from here to here. I might splice out that whole region, or they might be overlapping in some way. But the point is that it's possible for a single messenger RNA to be spliced in different ways, and therefore lead to different protein products, because it's the final messenger RNA that gets translated to protein, not the pre-mRNA. So that's why the question came up earlier, there's only a single genetic code, how can a single gene give rise to more than one protein? And the reason is because it depends on how the introns are removed. If the introns are removed in more than one way, I can end up with more than one protein coming out later on.
But it always
moves
in the way, right? It won't cut anywhere else except the...
There are a limited number of places it can cut. It's not a random process. There are, like I said, there are these signals, but it may be, like I said, that most of the time it splices here and here, but occasionally it might skip this exon altogether and splice, because this also, remember, this is a right here is a point that says here's the beginning of an intron, and here's an end of an intron. Here's also an end of an intron, so sometimes it might skip over this signal and go down to this signal. And so then it would splice out the intervening exon in the meantime.
So in terms of total sequence, they have this potential splicing, which are they overlapping?
Yeah, in that case, those two different proteins would be the same, except one protein would have an additional set of amino acids and maybe a new domain or something added to it. But there can be cases, and my drawing is already too complicated here, but there are cases in which the splicing is not simply either you include or don't include an exon, but they could really be alternative so that this whole set of exons from here on down all get changed. So I could have a protein that might have a common one end of the protein. The first end of the protein might be the same, but it might have two different tails stuck onto the end of it, depending on how the splicing is done. That's... I think that's a great question. That goes back to this issue of, people who think about this, think about it. I'm stumbling over my own words here. This evidence like this is actually part of the motivation for why people think that RNA was the progenitor that evolved first. You can think of this as this RNA itself as a selfish gene. I mean, what we know is that it can pop itself out of the DNA, but somehow it had to get into the DNA in the first place. So you could think of this as sort of the analogy isn't perfect, but you can sort of think of it as a virus. There's an RNA that evolved a function of jumping into DNA, and then it gets replicated along with the rest of the cell. And as long as it doesn't cause detrimental, that is, when it jumped into this gene, it doesn't kill the gene, because when the gene starts to be made, it has a way to pop back out again. It doesn't cause any major detriment to the cell. So it might just end up being a hitchhiker that's gotten carried through evolution. And since there's no strong selection against it, and since it's a self-replicating system, if there's no strong selection against it, it will just sort of proliferate. That's a little bit hand-waving, and some of the arguments in the area are, but that's one argument, at least, that you'll hear. But why these things exist? The reason they exist is because they can exist, and there's no strong selection to get rid of them. Since they're self-propagating, they just do exist. Once it gets cut out, once it gets removed, I think it just has a half-life and gets turned over. I don't think it actually finds its way and pops back in again, although I think arguments are that maybe it does that with some low efficiency, so it's a way for it to sort of spread around, but I think in general, in a typical cell, once it pops out, it just gets degraded. There's a hypothesis that I think there's some evidence for it, that individual exons correspond to domains of folded proteins, and so this was first presented by Wally Gilbert, the so-called exon shuffling model for protein evolution. That is, you can imagine these introns allow ways in which to recombine exons together. Now, as I talked before about what you can have crossing over. So if I take a gene and I spread it out to be really big, with lots of introns in between, that just gives it more possible ways of recombining. And so it's possible that you make new proteins by taking exons from old proteins and putting them together in new combinations. I don't know. I don't think the evidence is overwhelming for that theory, but I think it's plausible. Yeah. In part, although it's more complicated than that, I go back to this tRNA structure right here. So what it's shown is there are a large number of base pairs, but there are other interactions as well. There are actually, in some cases, what are called base triples. I have a base pair forming like this, and I can have another base pair that actually comes in and make hydrogen bonds on the side. I also can have interactions between bases and the backbone. And so it can be more complicated, although probably 90 or 95% of all the interactions are sort of standard base pairs. There's always an additional, some set of additional interactions that go on as well. Let me just point out, so when people then started looking around for RNAs that had this cleavage activity, there became sort of a cottage industry, and people actually discovered lots of RNAs that had catalytic activity. And one of the common activities is you can have an RNA that will cut another piece of RNA. I mean, that's sort of in essence what this intron did, only in this case it's cutting itself out of a molecule. But you can actually then And this is, again, sort of a cottage industry in genetic and biotechnology companies of designing a ribozyme. So they take this ribozyme, and there's a piece of RNA that folds up into some structure such that it will cleave another piece of RNA. And then you can target this to whatever piece of RNA you want simply by designing this sequence out here. So this sequence out on the sides here isn't part of the catalytic activity. This is just tells it where it's going to bind. So if I have a particular piece of RNA like this, and I want to design an enzyme that cuts at a particular place, I synthesize this ribosome where this part is of a known sequence and structure, that it has the activity, and then I attach onto the end of it whatever tails I want that direct it to the place I want it to cleave. So this is a way, this is an active area of research in terms of designing specialized enzymes for gene therapy. You can go in and, you know, for instance, you could imagine making a ribosome that specifically went in and cleaved, chopped up, you know, AIDS virus RNA or something like that, or some particular RNA, because you would target it by these sequences out here to whatever sequence you want, and then if you know, the AIDS virus or some virus had this particular sequence, you could specifically cut that RNA without cutting anything else.
I'm a little confused. The RNA is sort of like some very specific shape.
Uh-huh.
And if the codon and the amino acid and then here you have this helix structure.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just a section of the tRNA?
This is not tRNA. This is a specific ribozyme. I forget what the name of this particular one is. But
right.
But the ribozyme, this was discovered in nature. But what happens is that there, this particular structure right here, and I don't remember if this one was been solved crystallography. Some of them have been solved. The crystal structure, so they really know what the three-dimensional structure is. This is really just a cartoon. But the idea is that there's some internal structure of this piece of RNA such that it has a catalytic activity that it will cleave another RNA sequence which is brought into the right location.
But the red RNA is in a helix. That's most RNA is in a helix.
No, most RNA is single-stranded. I'm only showing you this little part here, and the reason it's in a helix is because I've taken, let's say the original ribozyme is just this part right here. And I've added onto it a piece of sequence here that I know is complementary to this piece of RNA, and I've added another piece of sequence here that's complementary to this piece of the RNA. This RNA extends out in a long direction. I'm just showing you a little piece of it. But when these two things come together, they naturally form this helix. And now I've positioned this ribozyme in such a position that it's going to cut this red RNA right there. No, it doesn't require ATP. Yeah, remember I said that RNA is naturally somewhat unstable because of this extra OH. It turns out that OH, where's that picture of RNA? Unfortunately, this is just showing a single nucleotide. Remember, the next nucleotide in the chain has this phosphate coming down here in OH, and then here's the next chain. This OH right here, especially at high pH, so that this H falls off, I can make this O will attack that phosphate, release this bond right here, and you end up with what's called a cyclic phosphate. And that happens naturally at some rate. This enzyme catalyzes that reaction. So basically, it causes that reaction to happen more efficiently, and basically just cuts the RNA into two pieces. It relies on the fact that RNA is by itself naturally fairly unstable, but it can speed up that process by a factor of 1,000 or something like that.
You don't need a metal ion?
Yeah, usually they require a metal ion, often magnesium or something, but they're not usually drawn in these pictures because they're sort of always around. But in fact, yeah, there's usually...
But the catalytical activity is...
Yeah, so it's not shown in this picture, but my guess is there's probably a magnesium ion sitting right here in this pocket. In fact, maybe what this structure is all based around just, you know, grabbing the magnesium and holding it in the right place, and that then leads to the catalytic activity. That's a typical mechanism for how that might work. It could be done with DNA, and in fact, all the natural ribozymes have been found to be RNA, but in fact, you can do it with DNA. And Jerry Joyce is going to be here, I think, and he's a terrific person to talk about. I mean, he's one of the, really the leader in terms of, he's done all this in vitro evolution. He's selected both RNAs and DNAs to have all kinds of exotic enzymatic properties that nobody ever thought they could have. But it turns out if you build a big enough repertoire and you have a strong enough selection, as long as that that activity might possibly exist somewhere in the pool. You can sort of pull it out and amplify it. Again, by PCR techniques, if you have something there in very small amounts, as long as you have a way to select for it, you can keep amplifying it up, and you can end up with a pure, large population of whatever it is you can select for. Okay, what I want to get up to now is the process of RNA transcription. Oh, yeah.
I'm just curious, what kind of biology are you using? Are you able to target certain people and do the mRNA?
For the most part, they've been used in kinds of gene therapy things. If I want to go in and specifically turn off a gene, I could do that by putting an RNA inside that cell. I mean, that's what the biotech companies are most interested in, obviously, is drugs and therapies and stuff like that. There are some people, and Jerry Joyce is one of them, who's interested in more for basic research purposes and trying to see what kinds of things you can have happen. Although he doesn't usually work inside cells, he's usually working just in a test tube. But you can have multiple enzymes that have different activities, and you can, you know, make a little... Nobody has yet designed, you know, a self-replicating you know, life in a test tube by itself, but you could imagine that you could do something by these mixing the right activities together in a test tube. Okay, so now we're moving on to this step. We've already talked about how DNA gets replicated. Now we're going to talk about how RNA gets made from the DNA template. So this is just a very schematic showing you that I have the DNA here. I'm going to melt it open, and I'm going to make a copy just of one strand written in RNA. So the language is the same, except instead of a T, I have a U, but the complementarity works the same. U pairs with C and so on. And so I'm going to make this RNA, and then the enzyme that does this, that melts this bubble, it doesn't need a primer. It can actually start, and so that's why it's shown here. It starts with a triphosphate, and then all the rest of the nucleotides just get added on after that. And what happens is it'll then continue to move this bubble down. The bubble will close behind the... Yes?
I
don't think it's understood what the...
How does this occur?
So the difference is only this methyl group right here. I don't think it's understood why T's have picked up a methyl group that U doesn't have. I don't know. I don't know of any. I mean, it might be a little easier. This methyl group here is the only sort of hydrophobic group. So this surface, when these two bases come together, it's this surface right here that's available in the major groove for proteins interacting with. And these are all polar groups here, except for this methyl group. So maybe it gives a little bigger repertoire of that lets you distinguish more to a higher extent between AT pairs and GC pairs. I think you have this methyl group out there. I don't know. I haven't ever heard of a good explanation for why T's are necessary. But anyway, so let's see if I have another picture. So the first question is, well, since it doesn't need a primer, how does it know where to start? So this corresponds to there being signals in the DNA. There's a region within the DNA that has a particular sequence that the polymer, this big blob up here is represented as the polymerase itself. And it can somehow recognize these signals. Now this represents E. coli, again, which is the most studied system. And the signal has at least two components, a so-called minus 10 region and a minus 35 region, in which the sequence of that part of the DNA matters. It has a particular sequence, the polymerase will bind to it. It then melts open the DNA, shown down here. Downstream of that signal, at the so-called plus one position, is where the RNA actually starts. melts open that bubble, and then the polymerase continues along, continually melting open the bubble and making the RNA, and then behind it the bubble is closing and the RNA is being released out to the side. See, here's another picture sort of the same thing. Where this big blob right here represents the polymerase. This is after it's already gone past the promoter, so it's going down transcribing. It keeps extending the chain at this 3' end. It's unwinding the DNA as it's coming into it. It has to unwind it to read the sequence, and then it's winding it up behind it as it goes. Eukaryotic systems are pretty much the same, except the polymerase itself gets much more complicated. The signals in the DNA get a little more complicated. But overall, the process is the same. There's a binding site where the polymerase comes and binds, usually with the assistance of several other proteins that are bound nearby. Again, it has to melt open the DNA and start making transcription, and then it continues on down the RNA. It comes to some point farther down where it finds a signal to stop, at which point it releases the RNA completely, the polymerase falls off and goes back and cycles again onto the DNA. So then the real issue is, in terms of gene regulation, I mean, there are several issues. One of which is, well, what are these signals? That is, there's a start signal that tells the polymerase where it should bind to get started. But furthermore, that's something that gets modulated. It's not the reason that your muscle cells are different than your nerve cells is they make a different set of proteins. So that means that even though the DNA sequence hasn't changed, some genes are being expressed in your muscle cells and a different set of genes are being expressed in your nerve cells. Okay, so there are other factors that are involved in making gene regulation specific. And I'm just describing that in terms of different cells expressing things, but also any individual cell, and this is more easily seen actually in bacteria and yeast, respond to their environment. So you'll turn on a set of genes in a certain environment, and in a different environment, that same set of genes might be turned off. So again, this is going back to an example from bacteria. The idea here is that this set of genes right here are the structural genes. That is, this is the part of the DNA that codes for proteins. Okay, so I'm going to make a copy of this piece of DNA into this RNA, and then that RNA will be translated into making a protein. There has to be some signal, which is referred to as the promoter, that tells where to start this RNA. So there's some site at which the polymerase, again, just represented as a blob here, it recognizes the sequence in this DNA and knows that it should start at that point. But there are ways to modulate that. One is, it may turn out that this promoter is by itself a weak promoter. It would lead to very low levels of transcription or maybe no transcription at all, except in the presence of another protein that binds to a nearby sequence, a so-called activator site. So this protein right here would bind at a nearby site. That would, say, increase the binding of the polymerase. The polymerase might ordinarily bind to this particular sequence quite weakly, but this activator here might increase the binding, so it would then up the amount of expression of that gene. Or I could have another protein that bound here, and when a protein bound here, it basically blocked the effect of that promoter, so it would turn away to turn off a gene. So you can see that there's lots of combinatorics, and almost anything you can think of has been observed in one situation or another. But it's usually these accessory proteins, either the activator proteins or the repressor proteins that bind to operators. These are the things that are actually sensing something in the environment. So in this particular example, a small molecule, cyclic AMP. So AMP just means that's adenine monophosphate, has been cyclized, like I showed you before, where the phosphates, that actually ends up being a cycling molecule. And in the presence, a signaling molecule, in the presence of that molecule, this protein ordinarily would not bind to DNA, but if there's very much cyclic AMP around, that cyclic AMP binds to the protein, and now the protein will bind to DNA, and so it will turn on the expression of this set of genes. Then you have to ask, well, what is this cyclic AMP responding to? And that's responding to some other signal. It might be a signal that the cell is in a good environment, and so it should just sort of be happier. It might be a signal that it's in a bad environment, and so then it should move someplace else, or it should turn on a set of signals or whatever. Let me give you just the same notion, just show you a few more examples. This is a classic example. One of the first ones that was worked out, the so-called lac operon. So lac operon makes a set of enzymes, Z is the first one, Z, Y, and A, that get turned on in the presence of lactose. Lactose is a sugar that E. coli can use and grow on it if it's available. If there's no lactose available in the medium, there's no reason to make these, you know, it costs the cell something in order to make these enzymes. So the cell doesn't want to make those enzymes unless there's lactose around for it to utilize. So the logic of the system is quite nice. So there's another protein that's, so here's the promoter for this whole set of genes. There's a set of genes. This is the one that actually uses the lactose. This is the one that helps import the lactose from the medium inside the cell. So it's a permease, one of these transporter proteins. I forget what that one is, but it's also involved in metabolism of lactose. Here's the promoter that leads to the expression of all those genes. Right upstream is another gene called the lac repressor. So this protein, when it's being made by another promoter upstream of it, because the orientation is the same here. So it's being made by a promoter. Here's showing you the messenger RNA for the lac repressor gene. This big blob here, if you ever see these blobs that look like a catcher's mitt with a thumb sticking out here, that's a representation of a ribosome. If you look at it in an electron microscope, it sort of looks like that. Before I showed it just as two blobs, well, here it's shown like this. But anyway, this is the ribosome. So it's reading the messenger RNA for the lac repressor and making the protein. So here's the lac repressor protein. And this protein will go and it will bind to the DNA right here. And so it will prevent all these genes being made. Now, that would be sort of the normal situation if the bacteria is growing and there's no lactose around. It will make repressor, but the repressor acts to turn off all the other genes, and then the other genes are made. If now you put some lactose into the medium so that there is lactose around, that's what this inducer is. So the lactose binds to the protein, to the repressor protein, and now it no longer binds to DNA. It falls off the DNA, so now you make all these enzymes. So it's a very, you can think of it as a very smart system for the cell to have evolved, because it means it only makes these enzymes that utilize lactose if lactose is in fact available for it to be utilized. So it goes on to make all these enzymes. So that's one sort of simple way. Like I said, this is one of the first systems that have been worked out in much detail for how a cell can respond to its environment and change its gene expression in response to that environment. Here's another system that is sort of the same idea, but in...
at that point, the lactose is still outside itself, right? At that point.
Well, a certain amount of it gets in. A certain amount of it can leak in anyway. Usually these genes are not completely off, but they're expressed at very low levels. So there may be a little bit of LacY that has allowed a little bit of the lactose into the cell. But suddenly when it realizes that there's lactose in the environment, it up expression of these by about a factor of 1,000. So if there used to be, one or two copies per cell, you now make 1,000 copies per cell or something like that. And so now realizing that there's lactose in the environment that can be utilized, it increases amount by a large amount the permease that lets the lactose in and the amount and the enzyme that uses it.
So the membrane, the cell membrane knows the rest of the cell preventing the lactose.
Right. Well, that's what this gene Y is. It specifically recognizes that there's lactose on the outside and lets it in.
Okay. So that gene controls the membrane.
Right. It's a membrane protein that is one of these, it's basically a pore that the lactose can get into. Here's the same idea sort of in the opposite orientation. So here I have a set of structural genes and I have a regulator. Now what these genes are involved in is these genes are let's say they make an amino acid, or they make something that's important that the cell have it, okay? Here's a repressor protein over here. So now what's happening is, this is a case where the cell wants these genes to be turned on only if the amino acid, let's say that these genes are involved in making an amino acid. If that amino acid exists in the environment, it doesn't want to make its own. It wants to simply utilize the amino acid that's out there. It doesn't want to spend the energy to make its own amino acid. So in this case, the idea is the same, except now the repressor protein, when it binds to the amino acid, now it binds to DNA. And before, in the other case, when the inducer was around, it came off of DNA. Now when the signaling molecule is around, it now represses DNA. So it turns off the expression of genes in the presence of the molecule that these genes are involved in making. So in other words, it doesn't have to make its own alanine if there's alanine out there for it to just feed on. All right? So it's just showing you the same idea. It sort of can work in either direction, where you respond to something in the environment, in this case, let's say an amino acid, and you turn on or off the expression of genes, depending on whether you need to make the products of those genes. So let's talk a little bit about the proteins that do the regulation. This involves also the protein that's involved in in the polymerase itself. But in order for these proteins to work, in order for the entire system to work, these regulatory proteins, this protein that binds to cyclic AMP, has to be able to recognize this sequence and distinguish this sequence from other sequences in the genome. Now, it turns out it doesn't regulate just this promoter. It actually regulates several different promoters in the cell, and they all have a similar, although not identical, sequence upstream. But somehow this protein has to be able to recognize DNA sequences. And so this cartoon is just a little bit about what we know about how proteins recognize DNA sequences. So again, I'm showing you over here an AT-based pair and a CG-based pair and the major groove. And what's indicated here by plus and minus signs are hydrogen bond donors and acceptors, okay? not charge groups. It's probably bad notation, but these are hydrogen bond donors and acceptors sitting in the major groove. And what you'll notice, the main point of this is that a CG pair looks different than an AT pair just in terms of its presentation of hydrogen bond donors and acceptors. And furthermore, an AT pair in one orientation looks different than an AT pair flipped around the other orientation. And so does a CG. So what that means, and remember, these are sitting in the major groove. Here's the DNA. The major groove is this wide part right here. So you could think of it, imagine, you know, pulling the protein away from you and just looking at the DNA. It is essentially, chemically, it's just simply an array of hydrogen bond donors and acceptors up and down this long ladder. Well, the protein itself, what's shown here are alpha helices. So the protein structure, we haven't talked about protein structure yet, but I'm just showing you the backbone. But sticking out of that backbone are this side chain of the amino acids. The amino acids themselves have hydrogen bond donors and acceptors. So whenever the amino acids that are sticking out of this protein, whenever I have a good interaction between the donor and acceptor coming together, then I'll get good binding energy. So that'll be a tight binding position. And whenever they conflict with each other, then I won't get good binding energy. And so you can imagine then how the protein can actually, just by what its amino acid sequence is, it will have high affinity binding to some DNA sequences and not to other DNA sequences. So the proteins can able to distinguish in terms of binding affinity between different sets of DNA sequences. These cartoons here are just showing you that we know quite a bit about several different DNA binding protein families. I mean, they come in different overall structures. A fairly common, although not universal, but a fairly common motif is for them to have an alpha helix, because an alpha helix is just sort of the right size to fit into the major groove of DNA sequence. So an alpha helix can fit right in there, and it gives it a nice, you know, long contour in which the protein sequence and the DNA sequence get to interact, and depending on the energy of that interaction, it either will stick there for a long period of time or it will just, you know, sort of pass over it and not stick at all. Yeah. Quite a few of these molecules have been solved crystallographically, so we know in intimate detail exactly what the interaction is.
Does the protein move along the DNA by sort of climbing along the major groove?
So the protein, I mean, I'm showing it here sort of like if it was stuck there. But in fact, if the protein and the DNA initially interact just by diffusion, that is, the protein gets made off of the ribosome, it folds up, it's floating around, and it's going to run into DNA before very long. And probably the first place it hits on the DNA is not going to be a good binding site. It's just going to be some random position in the DNA. So the protein might just, you know, bounce off and bounce on again. But actually, there's pretty good evidence for many of these proteins that, remember, the DNA is highly negatively charged, and most of these proteins are, in fact, fairly positively charged, or at least along one surface. And so you could imagine that, in fact, even if it hasn't found a good binding site, it sort of sticks close to the DNA through just electrostatics, and in fact will slide up and down the DNA. And in fact, there's very good evidence that in fact proteins find their DNA binding sites not by three-dimensional diffusion, but by one-dimensional diffusion. So having initially collided with the DNA, they then essentially track along the DNA in one dimension until they find their tight binding site. And when they find that tight binding site, they'll stick there for an extended period of time. The extended period of time might be 5 minutes or might be an hour, and that's a typical half-life for some of these DNA. Right, so now I'm talking about how these proteins that are involved in turning on DNA, how it is that they know where they're supposed to bind. Okay, so these are all examples, what's shown in the cartoon here are all examples of regulatory proteins. So when this protein binds to DNA, so this part right here is the part that recognizes DNA, and then this part out here might interact with the polymerase and help the polymerase stick there longer, or it might interfere with the polymerase, so it prevents that polymerase from binding. These are all proteins that would modulate the expression of a particular gene. This is just showing, again, a model based on a crystal structure for one of these particular proteins found in DNA. It's actually fairly common that when the protein binds DNA, it ends up making a little bend into the DNA. That's been observed for lots of these binding proteins. But I show this mostly to get a sense of scale. I believe this molecule is actually the CRP molecule that I talked about earlier. In this little yellow spot here, that's where the cyclic AMP binds. So ordinarily this protein would not bind to DNA, but once the cyclic AMP has bound to it, it changes the shape of the protein sufficiently that now the protein will interact with DNA and will bind tightly to particular sequences. A lot of it, most of the information has come from crystallography, and I think that's a real concern, is have you trapped something in the crystal that's not, doesn't really reflect its real structure and solution. In recent years, there's been a lot more structures determined by NMR or by other kinds of solution techniques, and what you find is, there are several conclusions to that. First of all, the data from the crystal structure is by and large pretty good, but the proteins are not static, they're dynamic, they have some flexibility, and for instance, when it's bound to DNA, it may be in this particular structure that you see in the crystal structure, but when it's out in solution, it may be much more dynamic and have some movement to it. And you can see some of that, at least from NMR structures. There's also been in recent years a lot of work on the computer doing molecular dynamic simulations where you put in all the force fields that you know about and then you let it evolve over some period of time and you try to monitor what's happening dynamically to the proteins. But I would say, there's probably no example yet where the crystal structure has really led us astray. It has really told us something that was completely wrong. Oftentimes, it's just giving you part of the picture, and in real life, it's a little more dynamic than what the static picture would show you. But it's not that the static picture is wrong, it's just that it's somewhat incomplete.
Can you talk at some point about the potential modeling some small molecules, like a
I probably won't, but that's one actually a topic that's happening in a couple of weeks in much more detail. I mean, that's not an area that I work in myself, but it's one of the topics on the schedule. I don't know if you're going to be here in a couple of weeks, but both protein folding stuff and also RNA folding stuff and RNA three-dimensional structure stuff is a topic in about 2 weeks' time, I think. So anyway, let me just start. So I talked about, it's recognizing these particular sequences. Well, what exactly do I mean by that? This actually question came up yesterday in response to one of the pictures that Terry put up. So there's been work. So this is a particular protein that we study. It comes from yeast, and a bunch of binding sites have been identified. Some of these have been identified experimentally. Some of them have been identified computationally. And Terry was pointing out, you make all this list of sites and somebody, I think it was David, said, those sites don't look very similar to me. And in fact, you can see examples on here where this site right here that goes CCC, CA, CCC doesn't look at all like this one over here that goes TTT, CGGG. They look quite different. But remember that for many of these proteins, Some of the proteins, like the polymerase, it's a very asymmetric process where it has to bind and move and make a copy in a different direction. But many of these other regulatory proteins, they can actually bind in either orientation, and it doesn't really matter what the orientation is, as long as the protein is in the right vicinity. That is, the fact that the protein binds in a certain vicinity then will attract other proteins to the area, and it will end up making a process. So in fact, this sequence and this sequence are almost identical. If I read this sequence left to right, and I read this sequence right to left, remembering the complementary rule. So this sequence read left to right would be C, 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 A, G, A, which is almost exactly the same as that sequence going left to left. So if, in fact, if I take all of these binding sites and I flip the orientation around as needed, so whenever I put a minus sign here, it means I flip the orientation relative to the gene orientation, I get a nice sort of a consensus sequence. Well, you can sort of look at this pattern and say, all these sequences, they're not all identical to each other, but they're quite common. And what I've written up here in the matrix is for all of the 28 known binding sites for this protein, how often you see an A, C, G, or T at each position in the binding site. So there are some positions that are very highly conserved, like for instance, it always has a C there and there and there. This position, it usually has a C, but sometimes it has a T. In other words, depending on the amino acids in the protein, some positions are very highly constrained. If I replace that C by something else, the energy is much, much worse. So basically, it doesn't bind there. There are other positions that are much more tolerant. This position right here, well, it prefers to bind to an A. In fact, it's pretty tolerant. And if I replace that A by something else, it doesn't change the binding energy by a lot. I can represent that information in a variety of ways. Here's one of my favorite ways. This is what's called a sequence logo, which was invented by Tom Schneider. And it's basically showing you, biologists like to think in terms of consensus sequences. So they would say, oh, the binding site for this protein is CCCCGGAU, something like that. It really should be a T. They're looking at DNA, but anyway. But that only gives you a piece of the picture, because some of those positions are, in fact, very important. And if I make a mutation in those positions, the protein won't bind there. But other positions, it tolerates a certain amount of variability. And this kind of a view gives you a much better representation of really what the specificity of that protein is. The way this is shown is the total height of a column is its information content in bits. It's actually measured the relative entropy at each position. And then at any one position, if there are more than one base occurs, the height of the letters is proportional to their frequency in the observed collection of known sites.
The consensus we obtained here from the previous slide, was it by sequence searching or was it by experiment?
It was a combination. Actually, these sites right here, we discovered, we had written a computer algorithm that would take data like this. So this is representing just a set of genes that we know are co-regulated. And I'm only showing you four of them. Actually, there are 14 genes on the total list. And we had written a pattern recognition program that would try to find the most conserved pattern that it could in all the sets of these genes. And this is the pattern that we discovered. It turns out then many of these had actually been shown experimentally, but that wasn't included in our program. So our program was able to discover a pattern that we knew was right from the experiment. All of these binding sites had not been proven experimentally, but enough of them have been proven experimentally that we believe that the pattern is a true representation of the protein specificity.
And only find one, right? It's the usual case that only one regulator is working.
Well, in this case, there's only one regulator that's involved in regulating all of these genes, so it's the only pattern that's sort of in common to this entire set. There might well be other regulators that are involved in regulating a certain subset of them, but we wouldn't have found that by our algorithm. And this is also yeast, in which it's pretty common that a gene might be regulated by only one regulator. As you get to more and more complicated systems, you end up in situations where it's much more typical that there be lots of regulators involved in regulating the expression of one gene instead of just one. So here's, I brought an example. This is an example from Eric Davidson's group. Eric Davidson's also coming later this semester. This is a gene that he studied a lot, and so all of the data that's shown on the slide is actually from experiment, not from computer modeling or anything else. There's a promoter right here. This is actually an important promoter involved in the development of sea urchins. You may not think sea urchins go through a lot of interesting development, but in fact they do. And this total set of DNA goes back about, 2,300 base pairs upstream of the promoter are binding sites for several proteins. So each different symbol here represents a different protein, and then each place it's marked are the known binding sites for that protein within this region. So this is an area that's upstream of a single promoter, but depending on which proteins there are bound and which combinations, that all gets integrated into a single signal that says either this either this gene is expressed or it's not expressed. And this paper, which is actually a very nice paper from Science a couple of years ago, talks about how you essentially integrate a whole variety of signals through the action of individual proteins to either turn on a gene or off a gene. And this gene gets turned on under a variety of different conditions. It's not only on in one situation, it's on in several different situations, but they all involve the integration of a whole collection of signals. The binding site is typically 6, 8, 10 for a single monomer. A lot of these proteins I showed you, in fact, all the proteins I showed you in this figure right here, where is it? We're all binding as dimers. And so I might have, you know, 8 bases of information here and another 8 bases of information here, which gives me a total of 16 bases. You know, and the binding site itself might be 20 bases with, you know, 8 important and then, you know, 3 or 4 that don't matter very much in the middle, and then another 8 that are important on this side. The total amount of specificity is typically on the average of, let's say, 8 bases per monomer of protein. But I can get lots of information by combining proteins in various ways. It's cookie time, and I've pretty much covered everything I wanted to cover today. So I think maybe we should just end it for now, and I'll pick up again tomorrow talking mostly about proteins, unless there are any questions people have. Let me write at this instant. It'd be a good time to take a break.
The issue is about the medical preserve of the DNA helix. Is that what 10 goes together, right?
The pitch of the helix, DNA helix, is 10 base pairs, or 10.5. So yeah, so if you're really going to interact with 8 base pairs, you've got to almost wrap all the way around, which is sort of what's shown here. I mean, it varies from protein to protein. Some proteins, their binding site might be only 4 or 5 bases long, and you can get that pretty much by just laying across the major groove. If you're going to have an 8 base, you've got to at least sort of partially wrap around the DNA.
Right.